Hey gang, it's Wednesday, December 29th. Listeners, welcome to the Behind the Numbers Daily Holiday Special, an eMarketer podcast made possible by Basis Technologies. I'm Marcus. Today's holiday fact: the largest gingerbread house ever made was as big as a real house. Of course it was. So if you think that putting together a regular-sized gingerbread house is tricky, try making one that's big enough to walk into. In November 2013, a group from Traditions Club in Bryan, Texas, constructed a gingerbread house that was 160 feet long, 42 feet wide, and 10 feet tall. Made with a wood base, it reportedly took 1,800 pounds of butter, 7,200 pounds of egg. I don't know why I'm giving you the recipe. No one needs this. 7,200 pounds of eggs, 3,000 pounds of sugar, and 7,200 pounds of flour. Oh, and over 22,000 pieces of candy to cover the record-breaking structure. Can you imagine if your partner did this? And then you were like, when you said you were going to build us a new house, this is what you were thinking? It would be pretty cool for like 5 minutes. This is the least practical. Anyway, all this week we are bringing you some of our favorite conversations from the year. And we start today with an episode from earlier in the year that looked at what makes a good retail website or app. And then in the second half, we listen to an episode about why marketers should be working on their mid-funnel or mid-range game. Hey gang, Susie and listeners, welcome to the Behind the Numbers Daily Any Marketer Podcast. I'm still Marcus, and today I'm joined by one of our principal analysts who covers everything retail and e-commerce. Her name is Susie David-Kenyon.
Hey everyone, so happy to be here.
Hey Susie, how are you doing?
Good, how are you, Marcus?
Very good. Tremendous.
Good.
I oversold it. I'm doing okay. Today's topic, what makes a good retail website or app? So Susie, Apple just launched a big redesign of its online store, notes Jay Peters of The Verge. The site has a newish look. He says new. I'd say newish look, and a dedicated tab on Apple's top level navigation with images and links to many of Apple's product lines. The new design feels very mobile first and features a lot of informational product cards that smoothly scroll horizontally. As Mr. Peters puts it, it's a fresh coat of paint for Apple's online store. So, Susie, got me thinking, just how important is mobile website and app design for online shopping? It seems as though, I'm going to say a decade ago, I may be way off on that, but to me it feels like that. About a decade ago, it's all folks could talk about was mobile optimization, sites being user-friendly, frictionless buying experiences. And now its importance seems to have faded, maybe because the pack caught up with the front runners. I'm not too sure. But we want to talk about ways that some of the best-in-class websites and apps are doing things, and also some of those shopping apps and websites which aren't doing such a great job, some of the bad features, the features to avoid. But we should probably start off by explaining where US adults shop in the first place. CGS said July of this year, looking at ways US adults shop digitally. Number one way was 50% online marketplaces. That'll be Amazon, eBay, places like that. In second place was the retailer's website. So a Target.com, for example, 45%. So just behind the marketplaces. Then way behind that in third with 22% was direct purchase from the brand, Everlane, Reformation. Behind that was retailer's mobile app, 18%, and then social media, 15% behind that. So that's where people shop, apparently.
And everything we always talk about is around convenience, efficiency, friction-free, right? Anytime we talk about retail and brands, this is really what you're looking for, right? How do you make the purchase journey for the consumer, whether they're just browsing or whether they're ready to make a purchase, easier? And so any website that has really good filtering, and if you think about that new Apple website, it is more glossy, but it's also a little bit more user-friendly in terms of, you know exactly what you're looking for. Images are easy to follow. You know where you're going and how you're getting there. I didn't actually try to see if I could purchase something, so I don't know if it's that easy to make a purchase, but from a glossy, shiny penny, it looked good.
Well, they made it easier in the sense that, so Jason Aiton of Inc.com noticed that Apple had added a store link at the top. So at top left, it says store and then lists out the different types of products, the iPhone, the iPad, the Mac, etc. I didn't have that before. It said they apparently they put it back to the top of the navigation bar. So they used to have it, took it away, and now it's back. So you used to have to click on a product category, say iPhone, at the top, and then get taken to the product page where you could learn about the product and then click buy from within that product page. But that made it feel as though you were always on the product page and the buying experience was kind of secondary, he says. So he said there's kind of always a disconnect from any of the other things you might want to have done, shopping with a specialist, scheduling personal sessions with experts or Genius Bar support. So they've created a store experience within that. So in theory, they've tried to make it easier to shop.
And I think that's the key also here is there is a difference between shopping, so browsing, and you're not really sure if you're going to purchase something and purchasing, right? So if we're aiming to do websites that are a little bit of everything, then you want some of that curation and some of the like lifestyle images, or for Apple, it's all the other things that you could get from a service perspective if you were in the store. But I'm pretty sure they added that extra navigation bar at the top because if someone is looking to make a purchase, and here is a tip for retailers, right? It's very obvious. You want to have the least amount of clicks possible to get to the cart and convert them to make the purchase. So
yes,
the person who's on the website and is looking to buy an iPhone doesn't want to go through 10 different iterations of filtering before they get to the iPhone 13. They want to just get right to it and make the purchase.
So it seems as though a lot of the sites, so I was looking just a bunch of websites, just research for this episode, and looking at like the top 40 sites, retail sites, according to this website or that website and apps. And I noticed that across most of this, the top 40 list I was looking at, they had a very large image on the homepage. And the problem is none of them really stood out, but they all looked really nice. But Tees Tea, a company called Tees Tea, they had a shop blends and then also meet teas with a kind of two buttons that you could select on the front of their huge graphic on the homepage. And it seemed to me that this was kind of a bit of a trend that actually they're not trying to ram buying stuff down your throat. What they're saying is, hey, welcome to the page, maybe meet the brand, let us introduce you to who the brand is. And if you do want to go and start shopping straight away, click here, but we're more about kind of inviting you into an experience.
Right, and I think that just depends on the brand ethos and who the brand is, right? You're going to see that much more with the luxury brands of like, get a feel for my brand and look at all the people that are wearing them and how they're wearing them and look at this lovely bag and it pairs well with these shoes. And that's very different than if you're going to a grocery store website and you want to buy bananas and milk, right? You don't need to see the curation happening.
Right.
There is a place for both, for all brands, right? So for a Walmart, it would be like, there's a section with recipes that then you can just say like, oh, I'm making a Friday night dinner. And so I want to do something a little bit different, or Sunday afternoon brunch. And then you can just click all that stuff to your cart that they give you a recipe. So it's a little bit like the curation you're talking about, not immediately going to buy the bananas and the eggs. So I think retailers need both, but it needs to be very, very clear and very easy to locate because consumers just don't have the time when they're looking to buy something. They just don't have the time and the interest in surfing and checking out all the cool things that you offer.
That said, you mentioned a few minutes ago something about filtering and about, you know, having a clear filtering and being able to get to your products that you want. Although I was thinking about it, I've never walked into a store and thought, all right, where are the black items under $50 in medium? So the color, the size, the price, like I go into a store, what I really want someone to say is, oh, what are you looking for today? And so I imagine that the search bar would have been a lot more prominent.
So I think, again, it depends on the website. And I have had so many conversations in my life around people's shopping behaviors. Do you go to a store and go directly to the brands you love, like a multi-branded store, and just check what they have? Or do you say like, I need to go to a wedding, so I'm just going to go and buy a dress, right? So like retailers typically are branded, like little, you know, brand pads between all the different brands. Online, typically, it's much more around the categories, right? So the way we shop online is not quite the same way as we shop in store. And that is a potential disconnect. I don't know if we could change their behaviors. I think previous to the pandemic, people used online shopping from a retailer website perspective, much more for the actual purchase, and use social media and magazines for the like, ooh, what do I want to get next? Or what's cool? Or who's wearing what?
On that point, the relationship between social media or a company's social media and their website, there was a recent PR Web article noting that nearly a quarter of small retailers do not have a website, according to a recent digital.com survey. For a number of reasons, maybe they don't have someone to maintain it, to manage it, maybe they couldn't afford one in the first place. A third of businesses say they've never needed one. And they said 29% of these small retailers, of their customers are not online. And 33% felt as though social media could support their online needs. Can it? Can social media be enough to allow for them to not have a website? Or is a website table stakes for every retailer at this point?
So I think it depends. I'm not going to give you a good, clear answer because I think it depends on the size. If you're talking about a boutique or like a three-store, they can't manage probably to have a website. They can probably manage the logistics of a website because you can use a Shopify, for example, a platform that helps enable, but then they need to account for inventory and they need to do, it's a lot of money to have inventory up front to be able to fulfill orders and figure out the shipping and the returns and how does that eat into your margin. So I think there are probably a lot of small boutiques that are one or twosies that probably don't really need a real website and can use a social media account to alert their consumers and maybe email, right? Targeted emails or text messaging to alert their faithful consumers that we have a new product in today or we're doing a sale or, you know, look at the new collection that's in. So I think they can use social media to do marketing pushes, but I don't know that they need to be selling on it. That said, the pandemic certainly changes my mind a tiny little bit because all those little boutiques didn't make it if they didn't have a way to sell their items online, right? And so probably there was a much bigger push to using a platform like Shopify. And maybe then they did the like buy online, fulfill in store, and they didn't do the buy online, we'll send it to your house.
You mentioned deals. I noticed that a lot of these sites had deals banners on the homepage, which I quite liked because if you're new to a site, being kind of lured in with a deal can work quite well. However, what I didn't love about some of these sites was the rush to get you to give up your email address, maybe for a discount or something. But it felt like within at least 30 seconds of me arriving, I was being asked for my email and there was a pop-up that kind of goes full screen and fades out, you know, the actual site that you want to look at. And sometimes it came up immediately within seconds of you loading the site. Another site actually forced you to enter your email in order to even reach the checkout. That seemed abrupt to me, and that they should allow someone to kind of get acquainted with the store for a second before you're trying to grab their email address from them.
So I think those are two different points in the journey. At the very onset that they're asking for the email is obviously a tactic to get more data about you and then to be able to target you. I heard a very long time ago, a thought bubble that someone else had that has stuck with me in terms of, I've just landed, you're asking me for my email and you're giving me a 15% discount. So you're already giving me the impression that you're overpriced because you're able to take a discount on whatever merchandise I want to buy. So like, is that really the right way for me to be introduced to your brand? Never mind how abrupt it is and how weird it seems at times. But at the same time, we know that if consumers aren't incentivized to give their personal information away, like a discount, they're not going to do it. And so there are other websites that offer you different things for giving your personal information. But generally speaking, a discount, like a small discount, is enough to get people to put in their email. I think on the tail end, when it comes to you're about to check out and they want your email, it's more to make sure that you have a seamless delivery experience, I think. And so that if you repurchase from them, you just pop in your email and you don't have to go back through the whole process.
Right. That makes sense. But they wanted it before I even got to, for some reason, that seemed too early. As though maybe I might get to that page, I realized the shipping wasn't going to be fast enough or something else. Maybe they, you know, they didn't have the kind of payment options I wanted, but they've already got my email address. So I didn't love that. I felt maybe it was a bit too soon in the journey. What are the best in class features spring to mind for you?
I think that digital wallets are critical. Once you ask consumers for their information, you should be following them in a non-creepy way. I mean, we talk about this all the time too, right? In a in a responsible way, and you should be servicing coupons in the digital wallet so that I don't have to, and that I can use in the store, by the way, but that I don't have to keep looking for my coupon and that I know what's available. And the smart ones even tell you which coupon is a best offer for whatever purchase you're making. So I think personalization, which is why they're getting your email and information from you, is what makes it best in class after you think about the filtering and the efficiencies and the like buy again buttons and whatever you can do to cut not the browsing component, but the like, I want to make this purchase and I want to do it as quickly as possible. The other thing I think that's really critical from a personalization perspective, which I have actually not seen many websites do this, is, so this goes in the like not working so well yet, but they should get to it. When you've decided you want something, let's say you're looking at a dress, you buy the dress, but then the next time you come back, you're seeing suggestions for that same exact dress. Right. And so I think personalization, which we've been talking about this for a very long time as well, needs to move away from the item you've already purchased to either suggesting other things that go with it. So complete your outfit. And there are retailers that are starting to do this, or people who bought this also liked that, but don't show me another dress. I just bought a dress.
Yeah. Getting personalization right is important. There was one site that said, had a section of trending right now. And I was thinking to myself, why do I care that other people are currently buying women's cardigans?
Totally.
That whole section didn't make any sense to me at all. Even if I was a woman, why would I, that's not what I'm here for. I'm here for the thing that I need. Why do I care what other people are buying? How about things that retailers should be trying to avoid when they're thinking about their websites?
So I think using any customer non-friendly language. So like things like juniors, a lot of department stores use that term, but it doesn't really mean a lot to a consumer. So I think sometimes companies get so entrenched in their vocabulary that they forget about how does the consumer think and navigate. So that's one, I would say. The other one is to use, especially in today's world, to use more inclusive terminology and to, you know, maybe not think about the plus size category, or like in kids, it's called husky, which is kind of like for boys. Yeah, it's not very friendly.
Yeah.
And the other thing, again, these are nothing new necessarily, but so important. The product details on a page, you know, if you're able to get legitimate reviews and people answering questions, critical. I think that sometimes we get very excited about full outfits as retailers. So we put the full outfit, even though you're just selling the jeans. And for some consumers, or like swimsuits, for example, and I know examples of the swimsuit is both the top and the bottom. It's not so inexpensive. So when someone's paying $100, they think they're getting both pieces, but it's actually in fact just one. So some of that is the way that the pictures are, and some of it is the way that the product pages are set up, right? And so I think bad product pages lead to poor conversion.
Before we move on to apps, one thing I did notice on one of the sites I thought was quite cool was from Alo Yoga. They were offering unlimited yoga, fitness, and meditation for only $20 a month, or a month free with any purchase. So this idea of trying to also pull people into subscriptions that you might offer through selling something, which I thought was cool.
And you know what? I bet that's through their app. And so my question to you and to everybody listening is, if you think about your phone, how many apps do you actually have on your phone?
Total
or
retailer?
Total.
Total. Probably about 60, but like on my home screen that I actually use, 20. And of those 20, I probably use 5 90% of the time.
Right. And so like, I of course did the same exercise and I was like, okay, what are the categories? I have a lot in entertainment, especially with streaming and podcast listening. And then I have some games, not a lot because I'm just obsessed with Words with Friends right now. And then there are like messaging apps, you know, there are social media apps. So when you add all of that together, you're at least, like you said, at the 30-40 range. And then I did a little bit of research. I thought this number was much lower, but this is a bit dated data. So in 2019, there were 25% of people had 31 or more apps. Mm-hmm. So when you add all the apps that you have, like your banking apps, your messaging apps, your email apps, like that doesn't leave a lot of room for retailer apps, right? And so then the question becomes, how do you stand out? And this yoga company is trying to do things that are available only in the app to make it sticky.
I see what you're saying. Yes, good point. Because the question becomes, why would I download a retailer's
app? Correct. Yeah. So why would you add it? So your app as a retailer, you need to offer the consumer added value that they wouldn't get from your website. So whether it's a price checker in the store, or Target has this geolocation type technology where they knew what I was looking for, they can ping you when you're in the store to tell you where it is, or when there's a coupon available for it. Or I used them over the holiday period last year when I wasn't really excited about going into the store still, to see where was something located that I really needed so I could pop in and out. So I think, again, apps that offer you something different, whether it's payment options, so it's, you know, cashless payment options at the storefront, or the coupons that are eligible that are in your wallet, or whether it's like the yoga club, there's another really very large athletic brand that has an amazing running club that's run through their app, that people download the app just for the running club component. So I think you need to offer something new and exciting and differentiated so that consumers download your app. Because like we just said, if the majority of people have less than 30 apps downloaded, not that they're using, downloaded on their phone, then you want to make sure that you're offering something cool enough, good enough, big enough that yours is going to be one of those.
So Susie, 15% of all shopping in the US happens online. Next year will be 17%. By 2025, 24% of retail sales will happen online, computers, phones, tablets, and 10% of all retail sales will happen just on a mobile device. And pretty much all of that, mostly 90%-ish, is on a smartphone. In terms of online sales in the US by device, this year we estimate that the desktop and laptop will account for about 60%, the smartphone for about just over 30%, and then tablet with the remaining share pretty much. Over the next couple of years, desktop and laptop is going to tick down by 1 or 2 points, and smartphone is going to gain those points. People buying things on a tablet will also decrease in share somewhat as well. All right, time for a quick word from our sponsor, Basis Technologies, and then we'll be right back to listen into an episode about why marketers should be working on their mid-funnel or mid-range game. Today's podcast is made possible by Basis Technologies. Basis Technologies has created a digital advertising platform that connects people, automates processes, and unifies channels, bringing together programmatic, site direct, search, social, and CTV into one single interface. And through the power of automation, Basis enable brands, agencies, and publishers to build and operate a healthy, secure, efficient, and profitable advertising organization. Ready to take control of your advertising? Just go to basis.net today. That's www.basis.net. Basis Technologies, the future of advertising has arrived. All right, welcome back. For the second half of the show, we're going to be listening into an episode we recorded earlier this year where we discuss why marketers need to work on their mid-funnel or mid-range game and some of the potential opportunities of doing so. Hey gang, Andrew and listeners, welcome to the Behind the Numbers Daily, an e-marketer podcast. I'm Marcus, and today I'm joined by our principal analyst who covers everything retail. It's Andrew Lipsman.
Hey, Marcus.
Today's topic, what are we talking about today? Oh yeah, we're talking about how middle of the funnel is similar to basketball's mid-range game. So, Andrew, we are unfortunately talking to you on your last episode. It's Andrew's last episode, folks. I know what you're thinking. I just recently told you that Mark was leaving and I had to break it. I don't know how else to break it to you. We know it's about to happen, but we haven't had a lot of time to digest the news. So we're in a similar boat to you. But yeah, I'm sorry to say it's Andrew's final episode, unfortunately. He's moving on to better things. Andrew, how are you feeling?
Well, bittersweet. I am moving on, although I will be staying in the media, advertising, and commerce space, so I won't go far. I will say I have loved my experience at eMarketer. I have loved being an analyst. Most of all, though, I think I've loved this podcast. This is the thing that I probably did, an episode a week while I was here.
Yeah.
And I would say it was very often the highlight of my week, so I will miss it.
It's been a great run, my friend. We're going to miss you. We've had some great episodes. My favorite episode, actually, at least top two, maybe top one, when you went down to the store for us, you went down to the Amazon Go store to experience what that was like, and you recorded some tape of what it was like to be down there. Check that episode out. An analyst goes to the Amazon Go store, something like that, from a few years ago. It was fantastic. That was one of my favorite episodes.
And by the way, that was like in my first couple of months at eMarketer back in 2018. And I realize now, looking back at that episode, that was one of my brainchild episodes. Marcus knows well, every so often I'll just get this idea in my head and say, Marcus, we got to lay down this episode. And so I think that was actually probably my first, where I was like, I'm going to go into the store, I'll get some audio of it, and we'll see what happens.
It's bloody brilliant. And this episode, this very episode, is another one of those Andrew Brainchild episodes. And so, if you are trying to do two things at once, and you normally probably can do two things at once with this podcast, you're going to want to tune in. So you can make yourself a coffee, get yourself a little snack, maybe some shortbread, have a seat and listen in, because Andrew's got some very interesting things to say on this episode. So Andrew, this one was kind of born out of your social commerce report, right? Which unfortunately is your last report for us.
Actually, my second to last report. I did have a holiday that came up right after that.
Oh my goodness. Okay, so this one came out. So when was the social commerce one?
This came out earlier in February.
Okay.
And it was my last deep dive trend report. And actually, it was the longest report that I had. It took me a full 6 months to do. And I learned a lot along the way. So I've had many, many thoughts about social commerce and what it is all about and what it means. And so, this is kind of one of those ideas that came up along the way in my thinking
and
about...
The way you pitched it was, I remember reading the email and you said, I want to draw comparisons from the digital advertising space and the MBA. And I stopped reading at that point. I was like, yes, of course we're doing it. I normally just say yes anyway, anytime you've got a suggestion or anyone has a suggestion. But that was absolutely had me hooked. And even if you're not a basketball person, there are some incredible parallels that Andrew draws between digital marketing and basketball.
Usually when I have these ideas, I imagine you on the other end saying, this sounds a little bit crazy, but I'm going to trust you on this. So hopefully I can bring
ideas.
This one home.
It's the best ones. So talk to us. What's your thought process? Get us into the conversation.
Yeah, well, so social commerce, one of the things that I think really resonates for me with social commerce is the notion of context and contextual relevance and how important that is to getting people to actually convert, to see something, in their feed on a social platform and actually be compelled to action in that moment. There is so much activity that we see passing our eyes every day in the digital world. And, there's a pretty high threshold to engage people and make them want something and be inspired to act and then actually check out either natively on the platform or click through to a retailer's site and check out immediately. So I thought a lot about, what drives that action. And I thought about it in the context of the biggest social commerce platforms. And there's often this kind of tension in between, which ones are the most important. The tension or the trade-off is between scale and context. Mm-hmm. So if we think about one end of the spectrum with scale, that's Facebook, right? Facebook is huge, but there's so much, and it drives a ton of traffic. It can drive a ton of click-throughs, but it's not necessarily the most contextually relevant because there's so much activity happening. People aren't really there, with a shopping mindset necessarily. Mm-hmm. At the other end of the spectrum, I guess I would kind of call out Pinterest as the social platform that is the most contextually relevant. It is, if you think about what people are primarily engaging on the site, it's all about, doing something aspirational or being a better version of yourself, or wanting to decorate your home, whatever it is, you can draw a very direct line from that behavior to wanting to buy something. So high contextual relevance, nowhere near the scale that Facebook has.
Yep.
Right, so those are the two sort of poles.
And in terms of nowhere near the scale, Facebook, about half of the US population, over half the US population using Facebook, and for Pinterest is about a quarter of the population. So a lot fewer.
Yeah, and people on Facebook just spend a lot more time on average than Pinterest too. So it's really sort of multiples higher in terms of total activity. Mm-hmm. Now, if you think about some of the other platforms, I would say Instagram has become a real power in social commerce because it kind of has the best balance of scale and context, right? It's maybe the second biggest after Facebook. So it's got scale, but it's also pretty contextually relevant. A lot of people are there to do a lot of things, but also to engage with brands and fashion and things of that nature. So it works pretty well in terms of balancing that trade-off. Then you've got some up-and-comers like TikTok, which, you know, the scale is increasing pretty fast. They've got this magic algorithm that can maybe help it drive more contextual relevance. So I'm very curious to see what happens with a platform like that.
All the platforms you mentioned, a lot of that is about the quantity side of things. Talk to us a bit about the other side of the coin, the quality types of advertising, which you think might be being overlooked here.
Yeah, so if we think about these platforms and what I just mentioned with the scale versus context trade-off, I think I've spent a good part of my career interrogating a central question, which is, what is the value of a digital ad? And often they have been kind of commoditized in what I will call the scale era. I think that we have been dominated over, you know, the better part of the last decade or more by Google and Facebook, which are huge drivers of scale in digital advertising, in addition to programmatic trading, which has also risen up during that time. So we've seen dollars and budgets really move in the direction of scale. All those platforms usually have good measurement surrounding it. But I've always had this nagging feeling that there is a class of advertising vehicles out there that have been undervalued because we have tended to value quantity, or in some cases, cost effectiveness over quality.
Mm-hmm. And who are you talking about there? What are those valuable forms of advertising?
Well, when I think about some of the quality forms, I came up with a little pithy phrase here, which is podcasts, premium publishers, and Pinterest. I think there are more examples, but you know the P's worked well. Mm-hmm. So podcast ads, you know, premium publishers have these really strong environments for brand advertising in particular to be seen. Pinterest, as we just mentioned, has this strong contextual relevance. What they have in common is that you kind of intuitively know that these are high quality impressions, but what they don't do is play the game of current digital advertising particularly well. They don't perform well on last click attribution. They're not necessarily the most cost effective. They can't post strong reach numbers. But you know, I think there's an argument to be made and frankly a challenge in proving that these forms of advertising and some others that I might put in a similar class, you know, should be valued higher.
Right. And what's stopping brands from investing more heavily in these channels? What's the hurdle?
So I call it the tyranny of metrics. And by the way, I should say, you know, I come from measurement world. I love metrics. I believe in using data and being data informed and understanding how your advertising is performing. All that is critically important. But sometimes we have a tendency to overvalue that which can be measured.
Right, we've swung too far to the other side.
Right, so when we only look at the data and the measurement side of things, we're missing those things that can't be as easily measured. So I think digital advertising really has kind of become like Moneyball, where these impressions that are delivered are they've turned into commodities and pork bellies. And basically advertisers have been looking for years to find arbitrage opportunities to maximize their ROI. And they essentially funnel all their advertising to whatever formats or audiences or whatever the case may be tells you this is where you get, you know, the most cost effectiveness.
So for people who aren't familiar with Moneyball, Andrew, do you want to quickly explain what that is?
So Moneyball is basically the analytics movement that entered into baseball, 20 plus years ago, that used statistics that were kind of undervalued statistics that, you know, people tended to gravitate towards, let's say, a home run hitter because a home run looks good, and they undervalued somebody who might get walked a lot. And that person's getting on base and they're helping their team score runs. And so it's just this idea that there are things you actually could measure but were being undervalued. So we've seen in recent years this analytics movement take hold across all of sports, but Marcus, you and I know very well how much it has changed the dynamics of NBA basketball.
Oh yeah. I mean, particularly in, you know, the last 5 to 6 years, it's got really kind of out of hand.
This is finally our chance to do our NBA podcast that we've always talked about.
Finally.
I mean, we wait
2.5 years. What are we doing?
We've had lots of B-roll the first 5 minutes before we jump on most of these podcasts. We talk about what's happening in the NBA. So we could have a whole other side podcast just out of that material. But today we get to actually talk about it and relate it to digital advertising. So if you look at basically the past 10 years or so in the NBA, the analytics movement has kind of taken over. I guess it was first pioneered by Daryl Morey, who is the general manager of the Houston Rockets, who is really a data geek. And one of the other early teams that started moving in this direction was the Golden State Warriors. So here are the basics of what's happened in the NBA analytics movement. The idea is actually pretty simple, that you know every shot you take has an expected value. It's the percentage likelihood that that shot goes in times the points that you get for the shot. So the best shots in the NBA in terms of expected value are shots very close to the basket. You have a high percentage of making it, but you get 2 points. And three-pointers, because those are 50% more valuable. So even though you make them at a lower percentage, the math adds up to that actually being, you know, a valuable shot.
Yeah, and it's basically like someone said, what's the best way to score points? It's either really close to the basket because it's high percentage, or if you're going to try to go for more points, the three-point shot, then do that. But don't shoot anything just inside the three-point line, which is still a long-range two, because you're not close enough to the basket where it's high percentage, you're not far away enough where it's a three-point shot. And so if you had to put it into two words, it's James Harden. He's the player who decided, I'm only going to shoot three-pointers or I'm only going to shoot layups. And for that very reason, he's got, three scoring titles and just continues to score multiple points. I mean, the top leading scorers of the NBA.
That's exactly right. And he had the perfect system because he was on the Rockets playing, you know, basketball's version of Moneyball.
With Daryl Morey.
With Daryl Morey. So the Warriors were the other teams. And I'd say, you know, maybe less philosophically driven towards this movement and more personnel driven. And what I mean by that is that the Warriors have had over the past decade on their team, the NBA's all-time best three-point shooter, Steph Curry. And then also Klay Thompson, who, you know, is probably among the top five of all time. Both of them shoot a lot of three-pointers and they make them at a very high percentage. If you continue to do that, you will gain a statistical advantage over your opponent. So not surprisingly, they have been the closest thing to a dynasty over the past decade. They had a four-year span over the middle to sort of near the end of this past decade, where they won three championships in 4 years. And the 1 year that they did not win it, actually, they were the most dominant team in NBA history during the regular season. So that 4 year span, I mean, they were just basically running over the league. So in that first year, when they won that first championship in 2014, 2015, they shot an average of 4.6 more three-pointers per game than the average team. And they made an average of 3.0 more. In the following year, when they set the record with 73 wins, they shot an average of 7.5 more and made 4.6 more three-pointers per game.
And so talk to the listeners about what then happened, because that's kind of the interesting part of this, is the Warriors figured out and the Rockets to a certain extent, but they didn't have as good of players and they didn't have as good a system in terms of ball movement. But the team started shooting three-pointers a lot, and the Warriors found a lot of success from that over that four-year stretch, as you said. What happens then?
So everyone always kind of follows the leader when there's a new style of play that takes over a sports league. So that's kind of what happened. And teams very quickly started to retool their rosters, their lineups, their offenses to play the same money ball game. So what was interesting is that, you know, over the next few years, the Warriors' statistical advantage by this style of play starts to erode. The NBA starts to shoot a lot more three-pointers across the league. And by 2017-2018, which was the Warriors' final championship season, they were actually only at the league average in attempts of three-pointers per game, and they made just 0.8 more per game than the rest. Now, they still had an advantage there because they still had Steph Curry and Klay Thompson, but you know that arbitrage, just based on the pure statistics of what they were doing in terms of their style of play, had largely eroded, and their advantage, you know, then really only came from what they had that was truly unique and different.
Yep. And so, yeah, to basically summarize what we're talking about here with the NBA is that the Rockets and then the Warriors as well figured out that if you pay attention to the stats, you can basically optimize play to maximize the number of points you can score. And they, again, would take lots of three-point shots or lots of shots close to the basket, and so would win because of that. Teams managed to kind of figure out that formula, started to copy it, and so they lost some of that advantage, but not before they'd won three out of the four seasons that Andrew mentioned. And so, Andrew, bringing that back to digital advertising, what's the link here?
So I think we've seen a similar polarization take hold, which is that we've essentially seen most of the digital ecosystem gravitate in two directions. Think of the parallel here is the close range two-pointer and then the three-point basket. I think of Google as the high percentage close to the basket two-point shot. It's very measurable. You can drive those clicks with a high degree of certainty. But the space has become a little bit crowded at the same time because, you know, Google's been around for a while and, you know, there's a lot of competition. So it's great when you can get it, but it's not always there. Mm-hmm. I look at Facebook then as the other pole of this, which is that Facebook's like the three-point shot. It's a little bit more full funnel, a little bit more dynamic, a little bit more variance in how you kind of play that game. But it too has become pretty crowded and, you know, it's harder and harder, I think, to squeak out that ROI on Facebook than it may have been previously. And you know, have heard, especially a lot of D2C brands in the last few years have found that CPMs have just gotten too high, where the arbitrage that they were taking advantage of 3 and 4 years ago, that has kind of eroded.
And so what you're saying here, basically, to draw the two together, is Google and Facebook accounting for the majority of digital advertising, the two-point shot, the close range, basically layup and dunk two-point shot, and the three-pointer now accounting for a growing share of the shots taken, dominant share, you could argue, of the shots taken in the NBA.
Exactly. So the question that I have now is, if everybody has kind of gravitated towards those two tactics and much of that arbitrage opportunity has gone away, the question is, what is the arbitrage opportunity in the current environment? And I've started wondering recently if maybe it is, in NBA terms, the mid-range shot. Mm-hmm. That shot that is statistically less valuable in isolation and nobody's shooting it anymore. I think about this, by the way, because I'm a Bulls fan and the Bulls happen to have a handful of players who are just kind of particularly good at mid-range shooting. Mm-hmm. So I've kind of thought, you know, maybe that's actually an advantage. And even if the statistics in a pure sense tell you not to shoot that shot, maybe if you have the right personnel and you can make them at a reasonably high percentage, especially because defenses in the NBA are oriented to defending the interior and the three-point line, they're leaving the mid-range open, maybe you could have, you know, a higher success rate on those shots. Yeah. So that's the first thing, is maybe you could just, in a pure statistical term, you know, get a higher points per shot on that shot. But then the second order effect that I'm really curious about is, what are the other advantages that you get if you take on that strategy? All of a sudden, you know, you're zigging when everyone else is zagging. And now you come in and play a team and their defense has to reorient itself to your style of play. So that's harder to do. Maybe by virtue of them having to collapse on the mid-range shot, it makes it easier for you to make passes down low and get those dunks, or pass it out for uncontested three-pointers and make more of those shots, right?
So, yeah.
So you can't just look at that shot itself in isolation. You have to think about all the other things that it can affect in the gameplay that might actually give you that advantage, that arbitrage opportunity.
Yeah. And speaking of that advantage, I looked up, I was like, who made the most mid-range shots in a season? Like, who was the king of the mid-range? And of course, it was...
Probably Michael Jordan.
Boy, of course. 97 to 98, Michael Jordan, 671 mid-range shots scored in a season. The second highest in a season is 564. So 671 in first place, 564 in second place. So over 100 behind is Dirk Nowitzki, the 05-06 season. And then just behind him, Kevin Garnett, 2003-2004. So yeah, it was Michael Jordan, king of the mid-range. If you think about footage of every game of him shooting a winning shot, a buzzer beater, they're all in the mid-range. If you think of other great players who had solid games, Tim Duncan, Kevin Durant, Kawhi Leonard, Kobe, Larry Bird, all mid-range assassins. And also, if you want to draw another sports analogy, American football. You know, a lot of going deep, you know, a lot of the Odell Beckham style, Mike Evans style, you know, circus catches, or a lot of, you know, routes kind of in the flat, or a lot of the run game. And Tom Brady, a lot of his throws have been, you know, those 4 or 5 yards to, you know, Amendola, throwing those plays basically like under the defense, underneath the coverage. So I think there's definitely that gap, whatever sport you want to draw comparisons to. I think it definitely exists. So I guess the question, Andrew, is what's the digital ad equivalent of the mid-range jumper?
So I keep coming back to podcasts, premium publishers, and Pinterest. Mm-hmm. And again, I think there are some other formats. I'm kind of encompassing them in that phrase, but looking for those environments that drive quality, contextual relevance is really where smart marketers should be looking more for a competitive advantage. I think they should, one, maybe get comfortable with the fact that they may not be able to drive immediate conversions or have those, you know, as clean of ROI calculations as they might want. I think that the really smart and sophisticated ones will find some clever ways to measure. I think wherever you can measure, it's important. You just might need to think about it a little bit differently and not look at everything through the click and short-term performance metrics, if they can think about long-term branding effects as well, how that drives awareness, consideration, brand affinity, and long-term loyalty. You know, that's really where customer lifetime value comes in and where a lot of the financial opportunity and revenue growth can come from for brands. So I think it's just really important for brands not to lose sight of all these other important aspects of how digital advertising actually works.
Are there any examples that you would use in terms of brands that you think have done this well, that have that mid-range game? If not, it might speak to the fact that no one's doing this, but are there any companies where you're like, they've attacked the mid-range really well, the kind of Kawhi Leonards, if you will, of the marketing game?
I think if you want to know who has attacked the mid-range game well, look to podcast advertisers. First off, many of them are B2B brands, right? And they're playing a different game than B2C. One of the things that they realize is they're often selling recurring revenue software. So it's all about customer lifetime value. So they don't necessarily need to convert. They don't need to think about scale and converting a lot of people. They want the annuity value of those payments. And so they can, you know, really finely target the right audience and convert some small percentage of them and have that, you know, drive considerable revenue. So I think that's one of the places that I would look. Other, you know, higher margin products that are advertised on podcasts is another place to look. You know, there are definitely some consumer brands that are doing it well. You tend not to see it as much with lower margin goods. You tend to see it with higher margin goods.
I love this concept of experiment. You know, give things a go. Find ways to measure what you may not be easily measurable. I think a lot of the time there's a lot of pressure, whether that's coming from the top down or just inertia. We've just, okay, we've always spent our money here. And so having a bit of money free to play around and experiment, I think, such a good point. All right, folks, that is all we have time for. Thank you so much to all of my guests that you heard on this very episode. Thanks to Victoria. She edits the show. And thanks to everyone listening. We'll see you tomorrow for the last episode of the Behind the Numbers Daily Holiday Special, an eMarketer podcast made possible by Basis Technologies.